Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Adults need to step into this place of being, I have so much in me that can be used for innovation, instead of, I lost it all because I'm not a kid anymore. Like, it's there.
We say innovation is not hard, it's hard work. Because the individual moves, the actions, the things that you do aren't cognitively so complex that you need special training, but it takes effort to enact them.
Why did I become an executive coach? I saw lots of great people fail to get ahead at work, while their much less talented peers blew right past them. That made me furious, but also curious. What were great people getting wrong? It came down to helping them re-examine what drove success, and then helping them make critical shifts, one hard truth at a time.
Feel like you're doing everything you were told, but you're not moving ahead at work nor having the impact you seek? Then welcome to 97% Effective with Michael Winderoth, where we skip feel-good, happy talk and engage experts in pointed conversations about what it really takes to move the needle at work and your career. So if you feel stalled or frustrated or seek that extra edge as you move to the next level, then look no further. This is the Hard Truths Playbook you never got.
Hi, I'm Michael Winderoth, and you're listening to 97% Effective. Are you stuck? Got a problem with your product or service, a process in your company, or even with your own career advancement? Or in any of those areas, do you sense an untapped opportunity, but not quite sure how to unlock it? We all get stuck, but there are proven ways to get unstuck, to creatively solve problems and innovate. And to do that, say my guest today, is less about applying a process or framework. It's more about developing a set of critical mindsets. Mindsets that you can learn. Today, we're going to discuss creative confidence and innovation with Richard Cox Braden and Tessa Forshaw, the authors of the book, Innovation-ish. How anyone can create breakthrough solutions to real problems in the real world. So if you are new to creativity and innovation, tried but struggled to be innovative, or looking for the extra edge dealing with vexing problems, this episode is for you. Because the world is constantly changing, very fast, full of ambiguity. So if you want to stay ahead, you need to develop your confidence and skills in creative problem solving. Not a nice to have, it is a requisite now. Rich Braden is a design strategist and founder of People Rocket, a strategic innovation firm based in San Francisco, California. Tessa Forshaw is a cognitive scientist and co-founder of the Next Level Lab at Harvard University. They have served as design educators for years at Harvard and Stanford, worked for or with leading innovation consultancies, including IDEO, CoLab, and Accenture, and consulted with clients around the world. Coke, Airbnb, the Native American Community Clinic in Minnesota, to name just a few. Rich and Tessa, congratulations on your book. Honored that you're kicking off the worldwide book tour here on 97% Effective. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Michael.
Let's start with the title, Innovation-ish. At first, when I got it, I was like, meh. But it rapidly grew on me. How and why did you choose it? I feel like there might be a backstory here.
Well, we started off with a premise of, we knew everyone could do innovation. We taught so many diverse kinds of people, but people didn't engage with it, and they had a lot of fear about it, about even starting. And so we thought the problems with innovation and the stories we're told, we need something a little lighter, a little more accessible, a little more innovation-ish.
Yeah, I think on a day-to-day basis, a lot of people think about, oh, I needed to start this big process or this big thing, or this project is already in flight. It's too late for that one. And so we started in class using this phrase of like, well, what if it's not about doing the whole thing as innovation, but instead that, you know, you just make this one thing a little bit more innovation-ish, this sort of incremental improvement.
And so the book really felt like an effort to shift the emphasis from a process orientation. A lot of firms have gotten into this field. You're kind of democratizing it, breaking it down that everyday people can do it. And so was this huge focus that comes through on everyday people and these mindsets that we need to be creative and innovative. First of all, is that a fair characterization? And you guys are teaching, you are consulting. I don't know how you have the time. Was there a catalyzing moment that made you feel this way and want to put in all the hard work to write this book?
I think when Tess and I met teaching at Stanford, we instantly connected around some of the central themes that are present in this book, and that how it traditionally had been taught and propagated, like you mentioned, in consulting firms, was a little off, and it wasn't the best approach to bring it to everybody that could learn it. And so in class, working with clients, we would often hear somebody come in and say, what about this framework? What about this creative process? At my company, we use this. And after we started looking at them, they all looked fairly similar. And so that was the kind of the beginning of our exploration, wouldn't you say, Tess?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I found that a lot of these processes are packaged for the purpose of selling them, which makes perfect sense to me. That's not a criticism. Like, I think that makes a lot of sense. If you want to sell something, you know, package it, have a name, make some prestige and some scarcity around it. Like, that sounds like a good idea. However, to teach it in a classroom, what we found was that that was not working, because very rarely is a process the same for every person and every problem. I think a great way to think about that is, like, if you have the world's best map of New York City, it's the world's best map. Everyone loves this map of New York City. And you have a friend who's going on a trip, and so you give them the map. And they pull the map out and they look at it and they try to see where they should go next, except they're standing in Yosemite. The map isn't going to show them where to go, right? And that's what's happening with these processes, was that people were documenting what worked for them at a synthesis level. And then people were taking them to other contexts and other problems that were in other you know, statuses with other people. And lo and behold, the map of the other city didn't work in that new city. And so we really thought that that was, you know, something to break down in our class and to give people the tools to think about how do they navigate themselves instead of how do they rely on a map.
Mm. I like that analogy. Rich?
Yeah, I think when we started to look at those and all of these different maps, they were all great maps and they had really good pieces. But the way they were structured and presented as a go from 1 to 2 to 3 didn't work for people. So we went in and did some analysis. And after looking at them, we saw that there were really only 6 mindsets that all of these different variations, I think it's over 80 at this point that we've looked at, are all trying to get at. And they're all a valiant effort and have good things in them. But the approach is to, instead of a map, think about it as just navigating, looking, seeing where you are, being aware, and deciding what your next step is while using these same things. So for us, pick any of the frameworks or toolkits that are out there. You can adopt and adapt any of those pieces. You don't have to stay with only one. And that frees people up.
Tessa, jump in.
We've said mindset a few times, and just the cognitive scientist in me wants to clarify what that is for folks. Mindset is a term that we use a lot in the book, and it refers to the mental framework that you use to approach a situation. So it's been a term that's been used a lot because of the book Growth Mindset, and that's a fantastic mindset, but it's certainly not the only mindset or even the first. I think a way to think about it is, if you've ever been to Costco and you walk in with the mindset of, I've got to get out of here as fast as possible, like, that's a mindset. It changes what you pay attention to when you're in the store, the choices that you make when you're there, the decisions that you make, your perceptions of things, and it changes the outcome, right, of that experience. Now imagine you walked into a Costco with a, I need to spend $1 million today mindset. Right? You'd have a completely different way of interacting with Costco. You would pay attention to different things. You would notice different things. So these mindsets are really mental frameworks that interact with our attention and perception and our decision making and help us get something different out of a situation based on how we approach it.
And if you extend that to that point around mindsets, you have a section that really stood out to me, focus on people, not steps. Mm-hmm. To extend your analogy, you're given a map of New York, you're sitting in Yosemite, just to kind of bring it home for people of like the mindset you would need to navigate even if you're in Yosemite.
So my favorite, and then maybe Rich, do you want to share your favorite? Because we have different favorites too. My favorite mindset is the insights mindset. And that is the mindset of I need to wander around identifying things that are sticky or questionable or, you know, that might look a little bit odd, or I need to prod in or ask more, things that are intriguing, surprising. It's the mindset of looking for those sorts of exciting bits of data that disagree with each other or incongruent around you and noticing. So that's my favorite mindset.
Yeah. To extend in a different direction, the maps and Yosemite analogy for you, if we translate things to that setting, so you might have I need to make my miles to reach the campsite that I'm going for mindset. You might have a take in the scenery mindset and stay near a nice lake. What you choose as your mindset really guides your behavior. And so I think for me, one of my favorite ones, and Tesla may smile at this, is the ideas mindset of being generative, getting a group of people to all work together to push for more and different kinds of ideas by changing how they look at the problem and define it. And the more that you do that, the more ideas you can generate. Turns out generating ideas is actually not the hard part of innovation.
And so these different mindsets, the idea is, you can kind of toggle or try them on or use them to generate different options or ways of looking at or approaching a problem, challenge, opportunity. Is that the basic idea?
That's right. We call those options moves. Mm. So the moves are the actions you take, the things you do. So if I have an interactions mindset, for instance, that's about getting out in the world, learning from other people and interacting. So I might schedule a few conversations with some people in the area that I'm trying to solve the problem to learn from them and have those conversations. That would be an interviewing kind of move.
The thing about a move that you'll just see from what Rich said is that they're sort of quite small and bite-sized. And that's really important, I think, for innovation and for innovation-ishness. Because when you are able to define something and contain it, you're more likely to do it. So a move, you know, being a small thing that you can define, put time around and understand the steps, you can go out and do it. And then when you've done it, you get that beautiful little dopamine hit of like, woohoo, go you, you did it. And you're more likely to do another. And so rather than thinking of this amorphous sort of either phase of like, I have to empathize with people, or even a, you know, oh, we have to creatively come up with a solution to this big problem. This idea of going from mindset, now pick your move, is really grounded in this sort of behavior of forward momentum and action.
Mm. So what's clearly coming through here is the cognitive scientist sharing things, yeah, and the design strategist. And to stay on that theme, Tessa, you guys start the book, even before going into mindsets, addressing that the mindset most people have is that they're not creative. That's not an entire mindset, mm-hmm, but it certainly does then dictate, right? People aren't going to embrace a challenge or look at it in different ways. And you use the analogy, which I think people can relate to out there, in a course, right? Even with professionals, you say, who's creative? 1 in 10 hands go up. You do the same thing with 8-year-olds, 9 in 10 go up. Now, the audience here and most people that you are teaching, college age and above, right, are adults. And part of the book does start to talk about adult learning. On the one hand, I think we do know, and you address why we have this innovation hesitation. Social conditioning, environmental forces, right? Most companies are restrictive and conservative. Cognitive cautions you lay out here, the fear of being wrong. Could you just speak a little bit to, kids do seem like they're generative, right? So it would be like filling the bucket or letting that bucket go. Whereas adults, it feels like you're scraping away stuff in the arteries, right? Are there a couple things that you would point out in terms of your work and learning, especially with adults, how you get them to be more creative?
I mean, I think one of the things about this innovation hesitation that always blows my mind from a sort of logical cognitive science perspective is adults have so much more knowledge about the world and so much more information and such deeper sets of neural connections, if I'm going to be, you know, neuroscientific for a minute. Like, that's the reality. And that means that their ability to be generative, to come up with unique solutions, is actually so much greater. There's so much more potential. While little kids have the capacity, like I have a 5-year-old and she can come up with a million ideas, the million ideas do sort of all tend to sit within the same sort of realm of things. And I bet you if Koya, Rich's 5-year-old, did the same thing, there would be some similar ideas largely cued by the immediate world around them. But for adults, we have lifetimes of knowledge and experiences and interacting with things and lessons and observations. And we can use all of that. And so I think adults need to step into this place of being, I have so much in me, mm-hmm, that can be used for innovation, instead of I lost it all because I'm not a kid anymore. Like, mm-hmm, it's there. You have such an advantage as an adult. And I think we spend a lot of time in class really helping our students see that, so much so that we hear things from them years later. Your class changed completely how I see myself, which is, you know, not what we're expecting from a class about innovation,
yeah,
but because we teach them to see themselves for all the assets that they have and bring to the table.
And what's a practical way you do that? Just one example, particularly if they've already, they're conditioned, right? That innovation hesitation.
I think one of the ways I see this, 2 weeks ago, I was teaching a cohort of executives at the Stanford executive program. And this question came up and we talked about it. And the thing I told them was, all of you were that 8-year-old and your hand went up and that's still in there. So start by reframing for them what creativity is and that it's there. So what I did was I engaged them in some activities that had them brainstorm ideas if they could use magic or science fiction. And then we talked about what are the worst possible ideas. Once, what we were doing is breaking down a barrier of, what if I say something that's silly, by forcing them to say something that was silly. And once that dissipates, there's a lower barrier to that feeling of social judgment of, if I put this idea out there. So that's just one way in one mindset that we can start to break through and let people engage in creativity.
So we do this activity that I think is really powerful for helping people realize the assets that they already have. And we ask them a series of questions that each relate to a different mindset. And one of the questions might be, what are all of the ways that you can engage people to learn more about the problem? And they will come up with, they don't know anything about moves or mindsets at this point, and they'll come up with all the different ways they would normally do that in life. I would ring up a friend on the phone. I might stop someone in the line at a coffee shop while they're waiting for their coffee and have some downtime and ask them a question. I could put a post-it note up next to the water cooler at work, you know, all of these things. And then we highlight to them, look, you just came up with, in this class of, you know, 20 people, 150 different ways that you can answer that question, that you can engage people to learn about a problem. We didn't have to teach you any ways. You already know these things, you know, and showing them that and helping them have that sort of moment of exploring it and realizing it before we explain it and name it is very powerful.
Mm. And then they get the dopamine hit and then they have fun.
Exactly.
And they enjoy it, and it breaks down, like Rich said, the barriers. This is really interesting because also reading your book got me also, you know, the field of coaching and executive coaching, working with executives, whole person coaching is about the person is resourceful, has the solutions, has the answers. It is ways of thinking about it and tapping into people's past or their experience in terms of how they've used skills to overcome things, how they might apply that or what's different in the situation. So I find that quite compelling, interesting between the two fields. Talk to here this element where it sounds like, right, you flipped teaching a little bit on its head. Instead of here's the process and we're going to then do stuff in the process, you just kind of start the experience and you haven't even talked about mindsets, moves, activation. Deliberate, based on science, iterating towards it. How did you guys lock into that being the most effective way and finding that it works?
Very much based on science, drawing on a long lineage of what we would call constructivist pedagogies. But it's called Explore Before Explain. Mm. And really it became well known out of the sort of learning sciences team at NASA. And I'm sort of the opinion, sorry about my cat, Stan.
We love cats.
I'm of the opinion that if it's good enough for NASA, it's like it's good enough for my students. And the mechanism of the approach is that you help people explore the topic and the subject matter first. And by doing that, they are engaging in sense-making and meaning-making and bringing forward everything that they know already into their working memory to interact with the material. And that means that they're able to then connect what they learn to like all of those places that they've brought it in from, all those neural connections from the things that they brought into their working memory, then they tie the new stuff to it. So it becomes much more durable and impactful. So once we've gone through this period of explore, we'll then pause and explain. We'll name what's happened, what's going on. Often we'll try to elicit it and then sort of name it together. And then we go to apply, where we say, okay, we've explored this subject matter, we have named it, we all know what it's called, we have a common vocabulary, and we've sort of made sure that we're all talking about a four-sided shape that's a square, and now we're going to go apply it to a different topic together. Mm. So that's our approach, and it's an interesting one because it only works for students who want to do work in class. And I say that with a smile because, you know, actually all learning, really good learning, we know from quite conclusive science, is effortful. Mm. But a lot of people do want to sit on their laptop in their lecture. Mm. And so our class is certainly not loved by students who that's what they want to do.
Do you force them to have computer screen off? Is that a requirement?
Yeah, we do.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yeah, I like this, the idea of effortful, right? That there has to be some friction, some cognitive dissonance, and that's how it really sinks in.
We say innovation is not hard. It's hard work.
Mm.
Because the individual moves, the actions, the things that you do aren't cognitively so complex that you need special training. but it takes effort to enact them. And that's really one of the reasons that we believe so strongly, and the book subtitle is Anyone Can Create Breakthrough Solutions to Real Problems in the Real World, is because anyone can do it. And we believe that you don't need special design tools. They're great. Bring as many in as you want. Learn them if you like. But when we ask people to engage in how could you do it yourselves, they come up with wonderful solutions to meeting the challenge of design. You have to design your own process. And so that's one of the exercises we do, is we have them look at many different frameworks and then build their own to kind of break the barrier of you got to follow the recipe. So it also means that everything you have learned in whatever discipline, if you are a marketer, a geologist, a psychologist, an artist, you've got moves inside that are innovation-ish moves. They might not be innovation moves, but they are innovation-ish because it's very inclusive. So you can bring those out. A great example of this was, we had a student who was a family therapist, and we got to doing some insights work, and she said, oh, I could just use family system mapping. And we're like, great, you should do that. What's family system mapping? And she explained it, and because it was a familiar tool she was very comfortable with, she laid out the interviews and the data that she had in a way that really worked for her and her team, so that they could take it and use it to move to the next step. I think I am safe in guaranteeing that family system mapping has not ever been taught in an official design class before, but it was a fantastic move for her.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean you have to go learn it.
Yeah.
It means use the tools you have.
Yeah.
People are, like you said, whole, resourceful, and creative.
Yeah, and I think a fantastic example of that, you got me thinking to, you know, some of my clients, and you know, I work at that area around navigating politics and organizations, advancing your career, and some of my most amazing clients, right, they were in sales, right, and they never thought about diagnosing the interior of their company like they would their clients, right? If you're doing a complex sale, who's the decision maker? Who's influencing? How do I get access? Where's the decision going to be made? And them bringing in those skills unleashes them. And so in a very similar way of tapping into people's expertise.
I remember a podcast you did not long ago, or maybe it was a little while ago, about a person that worked at AWS was only 3 years out of school.
Right.
Axel. And they were talking about their strategy in navigating strategy within the organization. They were full of tools and moves. It was a different context, but those same things can be applied to innovation if you put on the right mindset and that's guiding your behavior. The actions you decide to take will move you toward innovation.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that interview because he had gone to college during the height of the pandemic. So he had to very early on learn how to navigate and learn remotely. And that served him quite well when he moved into a remote working environment.
You've been listening to 97% Effective with your host, executive coach Michael Winderoth. If this interview is making you think, make sure to share it with a friend. Now, back to our interview.
Let's talk about, because there's a couple other really interesting ideas that I want to capture and call out here, because, again, we think of innovation, most people do. Rich, you're there in Silicon Valley. Tessa, you're there about half the time. So it's the great person, the environment, and in fact, Google, right? I've had clients who have been at their moonshot division. And so most people think about innovation as these moonshots, and that perhaps makes it seem challenging. You have this whole idea that you've talked about of start simple, start small. But I loved this choosing roof shots over moonshots concept. And so tell us a little bit about that and why that's important, how that works.
The reality is that innovation can be applied at every level of problem or challenge. Not every problem needs a 10-year, we're going to the moon kind of solution. And for every one of those that exists, to get there, you need a whole bunch of orbit shots. And to get to those, you need a lot of cloud shots, that it all ladders up into a portfolio. And the exciting thing is that that means everybody in any organization or group can be part of innovation and creating. Maybe your piece is a little smaller, but it builds to something else. And from the moonshot context, there's a common story of someone asking the janitor at NASA what he was doing, and he said, "I'm helping put people on the moon." So those small projects to bigger really cascade up. So we need ones from all over the spectrum.
Do you have an example there? You have a lot of wonderful ones in the book, but one that is particularly memorable for you. And I think if someone gets a roof shot, they get that hit of dopamine, and it really empowers their own. I am creative, or we can do this, and you can generally see them faster. The moonshot sure. takes a while. Anything that resonates with you from your practice?
I do have one. It wasn't scaling them back. It was a side project. We were working on what ended up being a 3-year redesign of a supply chain for a big quick service restaurant. But in the middle of the project, they spotted a smaller problem with how a recipe moves from starting in marketing all the way out to the end restaurant. And we came in and got all of the people, that was 17 different stops along the way internally, and got them to all talk together, because they needed to map out what's the journey of a recipe through that whole process. In that conversation, they discovered that the ingredients were being translated from metric to imperial a couple different times. And sometimes it would go to the next person and they would just reverse it. But they didn't know, because they hadn't gotten together to look at the design work. So the roof shot was just streamlining that process and aligning everybody. And in doing it, on one item, they found out that they saved almost a lake's worth of a condiment that was being used every year that wasn't needed because of a translation error. So that's a great example of that is not going to transform the whole organization. It didn't change the entire supply chain of a global company, but it did have a significant impact in one area. And that was the example that translates to every recipe that goes through now is going to be better quality.
Love it. Love it. Talk here, and I'm going to call up my favorite movie, right? Moneyball, where Brad Pitt is sitting there at the table and he said, you know, we're not even looking at the problem. You're not even looking at the problem. This is like my favorite scene there. You brought up a concept I never heard called framestorming. A lot of people know brainstorming, but framestorming was a new twist on this, and essentially is, what is the real problem that we're looking at? Talk a little bit about this, the power of framing and how it can be utilized.
Absolutely. That's kind of the ending of the insights mindset, is to get to the problem framed correctly. And if you're solving the wrong problem, it doesn't matter how good, how many ideas, what kind of prototyping, what you launch, you're not going to solve the problem if you're not looking at the right one. One easy example I use, and then I think, Tess, you've got some great ones too, is if in the insights process and interacting with people, you hear somebody say something like, "Oh, I really hate my morning commute. It's really stressful." Of course it is. I can just agree with that and say, yes, I totally get that, and go and try to design a less stressful one. But if I don't know that the stress is coming from my coordination with daycare and my time I have with my kids in the morning, or I've had several accidents and I have anxiety while being in traffic, the solutions are very different to those two problems. So in just a very simple way, focusing on the right problem leads to different solutions. And with framestorming, as our colleague Tina Seelig at Stanford always says, the solutions are baked into the frame of the problem. Mm. So whatever frame you put on it, that's where your solutions will be. You want to make sure that's right. Hmm. Tessa?
One of the reasons this is one of my favorite tools is because humans are full of biases, right? Not just like the big ones that we talk about all the time in terms of, you know, maybe identity biases, but also what we call cognitive biases, which essentially are shortcuts where we're automating or making something quite efficient in our brain, because that's what we try to do. We love a shortcut, our brains. And so one shortcut that we love is confirmation bias. And that is essentially when we get new information, we look at it to see what exists, what matches our existing mental models or our existing opinion. And we go, oh, okay, that, there we go. I'm right. Everything is what I thought. This is the problem. There's no way to stop that automation. You can't stop yourself from having confirmation bias. If anybody who tries to tell you can, I think that would take a lot of, like, many years of retraining and untraining. Like, I don't see how that would be possible. But you can know that you do it and then set up structures and practices to intentionally counteract it. And one of those is framestorming. It acknowledges immediately in the premise of engaging in framestorming that there could be many possible frames to this problem, not just the one that I am bringing or agree with. And so it forces you to look at data that supports multiple different contrasting frames and help you really start to bubble up what is the problem that we're seeing. So that's why I love that tool in particular.
So we can't stop those cognitive biases, but we can be aware and we can set up structures in terms of how we address them.
I don't think you want to stop them either. Mm-hmm. Like, that might sound controversial, but what I mean is confirmation bias is the same, that, like, the way we just described it is also the same bias that helps you open your fridge in the morning, look at something that looks like your bread and go, oh, that's bread. Oh, that's peanut butter. Right. Like, so I'm not entirely sure that we want to get a, you know, deal away with them. What I think we want to do is be really intentional and thoughtful about them and know they exist.
Another piece of this is that our brains are really wired to generate solutions and not stop for questions. So in the process of framestorming, we're suspending the solutioning, because if you think of the problem, go with your first thought, come up with a solution, go with that first thought, you haven't thought deeply about it. And there might be much more elegant solutions sitting around it, but you haven't taken the time to do it. And in another thing, since our brain is so good at giving solutions, when people talk about this step and this mindset in innovation, they say defer solutions, don't think of solutions. And it's really hard to tell your brain, don't do this thing it likes to do. So the way you can get around that, and this is where we kind of build in, use what you have and then find a way to create a habit around it. I say, take the solution. That solution comes from somewhere, an insight that your brain has given you. And then ask yourself, why is that the solution? And you can use a technique called why laddering to bring that problem up. For instance, NASA has space pens because they can write in zero G, because how do you have a pen that writes in space? If you ask why, you don't need a pen. How do you write in space? Includes crayons and pencils and, you know, chalk. And that's maybe not the solution. If you say, how do we capture data in space? Well, now you have lots more options. And so by taking a solution and asking why several times, you can come up to what's a more broad problem that we can solve in lots of different ways, as opposed to something very narrow.
Yeah, it's a very useful section of the book. So we've talked about innovation hesitation, the mindsets. It feels like we're moving through the book, the moves, which you've alluded to different ways. Then there's a section here around metacognition. And it feels like this kind of ties the loop in terms of how we hardwire those things and learn from it. In coaching, we talk about it as come up on the balcony to go look down at the dance floor. It feels a little like that, but Tessa, can you share a little bit of metacognition again in the spirit of this? Doesn't have to be some complex endeavor. What do people need to do afterwards to cement, wire, process things so that it starts to stick or become a habit, to Rich's point earlier?
Yeah. So metacognition for Rich and I is, simply put, it's sort of thinking about your thinking and doing. So it's taking a moment to think about why you did something, if that was helpful. What did you expect to happen? Did you get the result that you expected? Why or why not do you think that happened? So I like to think about it as, instead of recounting, you know, which is like, oh, what did I do today? Here's a lovely list. It's really thinking about your thinking and decision making and choices and emotion in that execution. So a quick analogy that can be helpful. My mother-in-law was a prolific diary keeper, and she would travel Europe and you would get these diary entries that were like, woke up, ate breakfast, Vicky wore green dress, like recounting, right? And to me, that is a classic example of, people would often say, like, they diary, they journal, and they're doing reflection. That's recounting. Mm. What we're doing is just replaying exactly what happened in order and keeping a log of that. Whereas if her diary was to say something along the lines of, woke up later than usual today, was feeling quite tired. I think we had a really big, you know, night last night. I mean, I hope she had a really big night last night. We walked through the old city. I was struck by how beautiful Vicky's dress looked in contrast to the bricks. I wonder why I've really had that reaction to what that looks like. We went here, I ordered this, it wasn't what I expected. I think my French isn't maybe as good as I thought it was. Like, you're starting to get more into what we would call metacognitive type reflection. Mm. And so in the case of design and innovation work, what metacognition is the thing that helps us not have a process. It's the thing that helps you decide what should you do next? What did we just do? What did we learn? Where are we in the process? What is the mindset we need to engage now? Why is that the mindset that I need to engage now? How can I engage that mindset right now? What would that look like? If I do this move, what do I expect to be the outcome? Let me see what the outcome is. And then at the end, what did we learn? What was I surprised by? Mm-hmm. What felt like a contradiction? Was I accidentally paying attention to some things more than others? Did we get what we expected out of that? What do we need? What's the most important question now? What do we need to do next? So this thinking about our thinking and doing this, coming up on the balcony, to use your analogy, is really how we start to think about what mindset do we need next and what move do we do to sort of answer the question that we have. And it's how we navigate ourselves without a map.
And is that exercise like, a lot, 5 minutes to it? It doesn't necessarily be time boxed or anything like that, but I mean, seems like it has to be focused, but doesn't seem like it needs to be something, to your point, elaborate. And I guess the longer you make it feel, they're probably less likely to do it. But is there any optimum way of doing this?
So we've turned, we've sort of optimized a metacognitive structure for this, that in the book, that we call a move map. So it's the types of questions and thinking that we think scaffold this navigation best. And of course, we encourage people to think about other types of questions they might need to ask and think of in their reflection. But really, for our students, when they come together to sit down and do a move map as a team about what just happened and what they're going to do next, we see that happen around a whiteboard in 5 to 10 minutes. Mm. It's not complex. It does take intentional thought and decision, and you really need to make sure that you're not trying to do it while you're doing something else, because, shocking, you can't be cognitive and metacognitive at the same time. You can only be one or the other. And so we want, you know, you need to dedicate that time, but it's really not a huge lift.
Simple would be intentional. Rich, yeah?
Yeah, we debated whether or not to put the word metacognitive, because it's kind of the you know, most $5 word in the book.
Yeah, it is. After
we went through it over and over, there is no word that really captures it besides that. And so that's a step to help other people understand what it is. What Tessa is so gifted at is taking cognitive science and translating it into everyday English that people can see. And that's what we did in the book.
Yes.
And so there are analogies like she just shared that try to make it that tangible, easy, practical thing to do, like the Move Map. And that's really that third component of what we call the innovation compass. So it is the mindsets, you're thinking in a certain way. It is the moves, you're deciding what action, and metacognition helps you to reflect, and the Move Map guides that thinking to what do I do next? And then the next tier of that is what we call active metacognition, where it becomes a practice and a habit. So stopping to do it intentionally is absolutely a great thing to do. And you start to build a sense as you go in the moment, as you're doing it, that adjusts how you're doing it midstream. You might be in an interview and realize, I have this feeling that's coming up that I have noticed before. I'm going to listen to that and change what I do next to guide where you're going. So
yeah,
you really want it to become a practice.
Yeah. Fantastic summary. And Move Maps, we didn't even get into that. That is a fantastic gem and section of the book. There's also another section that, you know, people got to go read the book, but I put these on for you, Tessa. It is my airplane cufflinks. But people got to read the book to understand why that's such an interesting and useful analogy to think about innovation. Okay, so we are coming on time. I want to do a quick lightning round, if you're okay with this.
Absolutely.
Some quick questions for you here. Each of them could be a whole podcast, so we'll keep it tight here. We didn't broach AI, but there were two things you wrote in your book. You say AI can augment but not replace, in referring to human creativity. And you also said that human creativity, I'm quoting here, is not just about following steps. It thrives on conceptual leaps and interactive learning. And so we are seeing AI invade every industry. Creativity is probably one of the last frontiers. Real quickly, one example from either of you or both of you of where you see and feel it's actually most augmenting and helping with the work you're doing, empowering others, everyday people.
I know that you said this could be a whole podcast, so I'm going to speak really quickly on this one. But there was this really great study that came out of a university in France where they had their students, a section of their students, do their design futures. It was a design futurism class, using saying they were allowed to use AI and really encouraging it, and a group where they didn't. And what is staggering about the results is that some of the people who didn't, it was very meh, okay? The AI group, however, was like sort of a very consistent. They all were sort of identifiable as having similar kinds of patterns and imaginations and of what the future looks like. And they were either very dystopian or very utopian. There was very little like nuance. So they kind of were patterned and consistent in their outputs. And then there was this group that didn't use AI, the other half who didn't use it, whose results were provocative, completely different, often asking new powerful questions, incredibly creative. And I think that's a really great example of where we're at the moment. So in terms of what I think you want to do is use AI to, of course, get yourself to that bare minimum. That's better than the nothing. But don't rely on it so much that you miss that like human leap and provocation of what it means to be human in the world. So, Rich, I'm going to throw you because you're the expert on how we use tools to get to that middle ground as a bare minimum floor. But I think that's the answer.
I think for me, a generalized rule of thumb is don't use AI for solutions. Use AI for questions. Help with your process, not have it try, not use AI to leverage to get the thing you need next. For example, we came up in one of our classes with an AI that could mimic interviewing someone. Not because the data that came out of this made-up persona was useful for anything, but because it let you practice your interview technique, your questions. We could stop, we could debrief, we could go back in time and make that thing forget what it answered and give us a new one. So we could use it to train us. Now we can go out and use it in the real world. So those are the kinds of solutions where AI can be really interesting and helpful is in the background. Coming up with different frames or variations in a brainstorming question to inspire new ideas. Another great place where it's coming up with questions to ask, not answers.
And so the flip side of this, hey, is there overconfidence here? I think we sometimes overestimate things in the short term, especially with technology, underestimate it in the long term. Is there anything else that you guys would point out that you see or feel that makes you so sure it will not replace humans and creative? I'm more bullish on it than you guys are. I'm a little more scared of it than you guys are.
I'm not saying it won't replace creatives. Mm-hmm. I think marketing, content writing, we've all seen it do a reasonable job at the middle of the road examples of that. Mm-hmm. I think what I was sort of saying, and I think this is true even in the example of, AI writing, is that amazing op-ed that you read in the New York Times that is authentically a human. Right now we're still not there. And I think that's true in creativity and innovation. And so I think AI is a powerful and useful tool to get you so far of the way up the ladder. But I think that level from good to great, if what you value is, the unique capacities of humans and the way we build neural networks and the difference between every human and our ways of thinking and when we come together, I think if you believe in that magic, I think that top, that top, I don't know, the standard deviation, that top standard deviation will stay. But I definitely think it's an powerful tool in raising the floor.
Mm. Fair enough.
I think in the near term, we're probably stuck at a sort of a ceiling. I don't want to make a prediction about 25 years from now. 25 years ago, we didn't have smartphones. So what can happen with technology? It probably will not be a large language model predictive generation tool, but AI has been reduced to that in a lot of ways and includes a much wider range of things. So are there other ways that we can bring computer and technology and software to potentially replace some of these things? Certainly that's possible. Just not anytime soon.
Yeah. Okay.
And I think the magic is what happens when you use the tools, the different tools we have, and you are operating at that, that top standard deviation of creativity. Mm-hmm. If we can use artificial intelligence to amplify that, imagine what is possible there. I think that is
I think
really
that 25-year future is going to be earlier if they do the LLM on YouTube, right? And all your workshops and all your writing and then your world tour here that's coming out. You guys also, it was one of the first books I've seen that credited AI for using it at the very end in your credits. Was there any one way it was, beyond proofing, right, that it was surprisingly helpful that you used it? I wrote my book before AI had really kind of taken off.
I have a fun one.
Yeah.
My training is computer and electrical engineering. I was a software engineer a long time ago. I've not written any kind of code in a very long time. But there were things where I wanted to break the book up into chapters or do a reading analysis of it. And I learned vibe coding using AI to generate small scripts and programs to give me a view of the book I couldn't have had another way. Oh. And that was incredibly useful. So it's very utilitarian. But I was surprised at, once I did the first one, how easy and how much I engaged with that. And I think it's pretty accessible because my wife, who is not technology trained, has been using it to generate queries for databases now with her own AI. And so I think those are fun, interesting, low bar. We didn't change the book because of it. We used the information we got to maybe make decisions.
So often we would come on in the morning at 8 a.m. and Rich would be like, I've been up all night. I've got to show you this thing I built. And it would be like this spreadsheet of the number of words in every section and the percentage of words in that one that were, focused on cognitive science versus storytelling or whatever it was.
That 8-year-old and that engineer still
What about the cognitive scientist here? Was there anything surprisingly helpful from your perspective with AI?
Yeah, that's a great question. I used it, something that I tend to use AI a lot for actually, is to pressure test things. So I would put a section that I wrote in and I would say, pretend you are a peer review editor and you are writing an R&R for like this paper, like give me all your feedback. And when you do that and you sort of tell it to assume that lens, it's less like, I agree with everything you say. Mm-hmm. And so I would sometimes get really meaningful feedback. And I remember this one piece of feedback where it was like, everything that you did in this section, like you just described a list of things, you don't explain any interaction between them. And I was like, damn it, it's right. Like, this sucks.
So a really good sparring partner. Yeah. Yes. And I would add to this, but I found it helpful is we get in our tunnels and we start to confirmation bias, to your point, read the people who confirm the things we want to say. Who's a scholar out there, peer-reviewed articles that would contradict this with some evidence? Mm-hmm. So I find that reading that is quite useful. Quick question here on just an aha moment, something that transformed you on your whole journey to where you're at now. One thing.
Yeah, for me, that big aha moment came when I read a paper about this idea of distributed intelligence by Professor Roy P. at Stanford. And the paper essentially is saying that our intelligence and our capacity for intelligence as humans is distributed by the communities that we're part of, the technologies and resources that we have access to, and is not just something that we innately hold in ourselves as an individual. And at the time that I read that, I was a master's student at Stanford. And, you know, I grew up in Australia, and I remember in Australia sitting in my high school library reading a brochure about Harvard being like, I'll never go to a school like that. Like, that was just not a thing you did from where I came from. And being like, this explains why my learning is happening so quickly here at Stanford. It's not me. It's this notion of distributed intelligence, and it's now all of the people and resources that I have access to. And that just fundamentally changed how I thought about the human mind and really helped me see us as people situated in context with others and with tools.
Fascinating.
I would say for me, to engage in innovation and design, it is intrinsically a team sport. You have to collaborate. And that means you also have to let go of your ego. And that happened for me when I spent a dozen years teaching and performing improv in San Francisco, where it is incredibly creative. You have an unlimited palette and you have to work together, all shaping and building at the same time, adjusting to other people. And that's a great analogy for a design project, is taking whatever Tessa has said, incorporating into mine, accepting it, and then building on it as an overall process. And that was definitely transformative to me.
Hmm. Yeah, Rich, you have many talents, and I know improv is has fed a lot of those.
Musical theater improv, Michael. Come on.
And let me ask you guys, because one of the in this field of creativity and innovation, Edward de Bono's works always resonated with me when I read them, Lateral Thinking and Six Hats. And my kind of question here is like, he doesn't get cited a lot, or it seems like people have forgotten him. Is that true, or am I just, you know, some confirmation bias, or ChatGPT's not pulling him up?
I mean, you have some De Bono fans right here.
Yeah. Okay, all right. So we'll leave it at that. So he's not forgotten, or hasn't been brushed under the table for some other reason.
The beautiful thing about his work, Michael, is that it's hats.
Yeah.
This is, I think, quite a similar analogy to mindsets. Is the idea that you put on the hat,
right,
and then that influences the role that you're playing, what you're paying attention to, what your perceptions you internalize, you know, what decisions you make, your actions, in a similar way to a mindset. I think that his hat is a euphemism for mindset.
Yeah.
Also, everyone can wear any of the hats,
right?
Just like everyone can. You might have a favorite. You might dwell in one or have a default, but you can put on any mindset as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Another story, but his training was really helpful when I had my team in China and we were doing innovation work and everyone could wear that hat and could play a different role. It really was a transformative force. And top personal habit from you guys, when you get stuck, to help you like kind of quickly get unstuck. Is there something, you know, in your unstructured part of the day you might do that, boom, that really releases the juices?
I have two. One is sometimes I go for a walk. I'm just like, put it down, walk around the block. Like I think my neighbors around here think I'm crazy because I'm just like off and doing a lap of the block. The second, that doesn't mean I'm not crazy, but the second one for me is sometimes I say to myself, all right, well, what would you do if it wasn't the perfect answer? What, okay, show me what the bad one is. You know, so to get over that like idea of it has to be this email that I'm writing to this important person has to be perfect to this, whatever it is that I'm doing. I'll be like, well, what's the bad one? Let's do that first. And that really helps me just get into it.
This came up for me a lot writing the book, where I would be writing and I would write the same paragraph four times, hating each one. And I was like, now is not the time to write this. Now is the time to do a different thing. And maybe it's go into the house. Maybe it's work on something else that's, you know, a little more familiar and come back to it later. Absolutely. And the other thing is, in fact, it's sitting right back here, is I picked up my guitar, which I had not been playing as much, but when I would get stuck, I would stop and play a few songs. And that became a great reset for me to sometimes in the middle of it, an idea would pop in. And sometimes it was just like a palate cleanser before I would move on.
Last one for the parents out there and for myself, right? My kids are older than yours. Yours are still in very creative mode. Something sometimes happens, right? Like in the teen years where they feel like they're not as confident. They're not creative. Is there like a simple intervention or things that would be helpful to think about as parents, as their kids go through that phase where they might start to question their creativity or lose it?
One of the things that I worked hard to build in for my kids, and now they do it unprompted, is they will say, I can't do this beat yet. And they routinely are doing that. The possibility of getting there is always with them. And I think I'm hoping that will stay, who knows with teenagers, what goes on in there. But I'm hoping that's one thing that will help them when they get stuck or they're feeling like they need to be creative is to do that.
I think I have two answers to this. So with my own kids, something that I teach them because that they are younger, something that we work a lot on is whenever they're having a tough time with something, we come up with multiple different ways that you could do something. So I'm always trying to teach them to be generative and to think of a few options. So never sort of in a singular fashion, because I figure like if they get into that habit, which they do, then they start to, you know, think of a few different things and combine them together and et cetera. But in high school classrooms, which Rich and I sometimes find ourselves in, a particular brainstorming activity that I find that age love is this notion of combinatorics. So instead of asking them to come up with like unstructured brainstorming, like everyone come up with all the ideas for what we could do if we were going on holiday tomorrow. I don't know, Mom, like, what are you talking, you know, like you, that, like that posture that you get from the teenagers, that unstructured kind of brainstorm, giving them something to connect to. So like, well, what if we were going on a holiday tomorrow and we had to go somewhere where we flew, or we were going somewhere where we could eat hot dogs by the beach, and then giving them like a way to a constraint and something to connect and combine it to. Or what if we needed to go on a holiday to a place that could also be a place where we did some learning. So that this kind of specificity helps them it sort of tricks them into being creative because it's kind of got an analytical vibe to it, if that makes sense. So that sort of tool of giving them constraints, of adding a, it has to include this part of it, or combine these two ideas and let's come up with something, is really, really helpful with that age group.
Love it.
One other tool that I love is, it's called the Story Spine, sometimes the Pixar Pitch, by a guy named Ken Adams. And it's just an 8-line sentence start to tell a story. So originally, my kids would ask for stories and I would make them up using it. Once upon a time and every day, but one day, and it builds. Then they started to figure out what I was doing, and I would just give them the prompt, and they started telling their own stories. And now my daughter is an excellent storyteller. And in doing that practice, my son has picked up on what a story is supposed to sound like, because he is 4, almost 5. And he will tell long stories in the style of a story. So he's practicing those skills, even though the narrative doesn't always work as well. But so they're both working on different aspects of that. And I think that is a lifelong gift of telling stories. And if you ever need a story in a pinch, that thing is fantastic.
So much inspiration from children. And you guys referenced in the book, Not a Box. That book, it was just sitting there on my shelf. The kids love that. And the hey for the cardboard box is the best toy ever invented. Rich and Tessa, the book, the website, reaching you guys, I'm going to put those in the show notes. But real quickly, what is the best way to see you guys, engage with you? It is being released. It is out there.
Absolutely. I mean, innovationish.com has all the information about the book, including a link to our Substack, so everybody can access it. And we're giving some updates, and that'll continue to be a growing resource that we have.
Thank you guys so much. I've really enjoyed this, talking about the book. It is fantastic. Innovation-ish, how anyone can create breakthrough solutions to real problems in the real world. Rich Braden, Tessa Forshaw, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for listening to 97% Effective, where we skip happy talk and help you break through and ascend one hard truth at a time. Help others discover this show. Leave a review and rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you like what you heard, you can get free resources, including the first chapters of Michael's book, Get Promoted, on his website, www.changwinderoth.com. That's www.changwenderoth.com.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.